You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show...
Based on the executive order that I signed in response to Russia's initial intervention in Ukraine, we're imposing sanctions on more senior officials of the Russian government.
Barack Obama gets tougher on Russia. Kathleen Burke and Matthew Jameson will be with me to assess whether these new measures could actually have an impact on Moscow. Plus, we'll go through the other big stories of the day, from Venezuela's crackdown on government opponents to the way French courts deal with rogue traders. Then we'll find out how Cannes attracts not only film types, but also real estate moguls around this time of the year.
You can open up about things, you can talk things off the record, you can make progress in negotiations in a way that you just don't back home. So from that point of view, it's important.
All that plus we'll be in Amsterdam and we will give you some good book recommendations. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest news.
The United States is imposing new sanctions on Russia as the crisis in Ukraine continues. They target 20 individuals, including Vladimir Putin's chief of staff and a number of others close to the Russian president. EU leaders are meeting in Brussels and are expected to agree a further package of sanctions after Russia's move to annex Crimea. The British Prime Minister David Cameron said it was vital they remain united.
What Russia has done is unacceptable, and the countries of the European Union need to speak with a clear and united voice. What that means is more asset freezes and travel bans, more action specifically in respect of what's happened in the Crimea, but also it means making sure that we do everything we can to help build a strong and democratic Ukraine.
The international search for debris, possibly linked to the missing Malaysia Airlines plane, has been halted for the day. Bad weather hampered attempts by Australia, New Zealand and the US to find two objects spotted by satellite imagery around 1,500 miles southwest of Perth. It's almost 2 weeks now since the plane disappeared with 239 people on board. Ian Colling is a flight lieutenant with the Royal Australian Air Force who's involved in the search.
Very remote in the southwestern part of the Indian Ocean, probably about 1,500 nautical miles to the southwest of Perth. So very remote and a very large, expansive area that we need to search.
A senior UN official has warned of terrifying levels of hatred between rival communities in the Central African Republic. The human rights chief, Navi Pillay, has just returned from a two-day visit to the country, where she saw evidence of extreme violence, torture, and even cannibalism. She says French and African peacekeepers have managed to contain the mass killings seen months ago, but warned thousands of Muslims are still in great danger. Almost half of Syria's stockpile of chemical weapons has now been removed from the country, according to officials overseeing the operation. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons is hoping to destroy or remove all of Syria's chemical arsenal by the end of June. Meanwhile, campaigners have again warned that hundreds of thousands of Syrian children who have fled the country's civil war are not getting any education. Toby Fricker from UNICEF says it's vital they get help.
In the future, these kids are going to go back to Syria. They're going to play a key role in rebuilding the country. And to do that, they need to be educated, or they need to at least have gone through the basic literacy, basic numeracy, to be able to fulfill their potential as much as they can.
Police in South Africa must investigate allegations of corruption against the country's president. The main opposition party has made a formal complaint over Jacob Zuma's use of public money to improve one of his private homes. It cost taxpayers $23 million. An earlier government investigation cleared Mr. Zuma of any wrongdoing, saying the changes were needed for security reasons. Afghanistan has freed another 77 prisoners, despite warnings from foreign troops that they could pose a security threat. They were freed from Bagram prison, which was transferred to Afghan control last year. Earlier, 10 police officers were killed in a Taliban attack on a police station in Jalalabad in the east of Afghanistan. And a controversial church leader in the United States, notorious around the world for its anti-gay protests, has died. Fred Phelps was 84. His group picketed the funerals of US soldiers, claiming their deaths were divine punishment for America's tolerance of homosexuality. Phelps' actions led to new laws to limit the right to protest at funerals. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne. We'll get more news headlines here on Monocle 24 in 25 minutes. You're listening to Midori House. We are back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 14.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are Kathleen Burke, Professor of International Relations and US expert at the University College of London, and Matthew Jamieson, Consultant Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start with the US, Russia and Ukraine. US President Obama announced today further sanctions on Russian officials, businessmen and a bank over the crisis in Crimea. Obama also said he had signed a new order that will allow him to impose sanctions on Russian industrial sectors. Before we go any further, let's listen to the US President speaking at the White House.
Based on the executive order that I signed in response to Russia's initial intervention in Ukraine, we're imposing sanctions on more senior officials of the Russian government. In addition, we are today sanctioning a number of other individuals with substantial resources and influence who provide material support to the Russian leadership, as well as a bank that provides material support to these individuals. Now, we're taking these steps as part of our response to what Russia has already done in Crimea. At the same time, the world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military in a way that could lead to further incursions into southern and eastern Ukraine.
That was the US President Barack Obama. Kathleen and Matthew, what are your first thoughts regarding these new sanctions?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, on the face of it, you think, oh, yes, and who cares? Especially, why would Putin care? The problem is that economic sanctions are only useful when they're directed against someone who cares about economics. And there's very little evidence that Putin and his coterie care about economics. So therefore, although it's, I suppose, the beginning of a ratcheting up, it's a type of sanction that will have minimal impact, irritating perhaps.
Well, this really presents a direct challenge, I think, to the central tenets of President Obama's foreign policy philosophy, which is his inclination to use sanctions to punish rather than going for direct military confrontation. I agree with Kathleen in the sense, I mean, I heard some of the Russian individuals who have been named in these sanctions saying, you know, well, I don't travel to the West and I don't have a bank account in the West, so it's not really going to affect me very much. I do feel as though the initial stages of these sanctions were slightly symbolic, but we are seeing now, I think, more and more harder hitting sanctions coming through. And I hope that that will be the case in the days to come.
But the problem is, of course, is that sanctions that hurt Russia will also hurt the West. Won't hurt the United States so much, but Europe will suffer. I mean, if for example, one attacks European, you know, I mean, the Russian finance, the, you know, more of the banks, Russia can just turn off the gas to Germany.
I think it's interesting that you mention that Putin just doesn't care when it comes to economic sanctions. How can he not care, considering that we're actually talking about the Russian economy and he is going to be faced with that problem sooner or later?
Yeah, it's more later, isn't it? I mean, economic sanctions can take up to 3 years. Think of Iran. It's only in the past year where they've really made much of an impact. It only takes 10 hours drive to go from Russia to Germany. Not that we are going to anticipate a Russian invasion, but the point is that Putin, if he has strong intentions about Moldova or eastern Ukraine or whatever, they can be done and settled before any economic sanctions even begin to appear over the horizon.
I would just slightly dissent from Kathleen's point in the sense that I think economics are quite important to Putin, because the price of oil has to be at $117 a barrel in order for the Russian government actually to be able to balance its federal budget. And of course, the Russian economy is now so heavily reliant on oil and gas exports. So even though, you know, Europe is dependent, especially Germany, on those imports, Russia is also dependent on being able to sell those exports. Furthermore, the sanctions really will take effect over a longer time, but it's important to start the process now.
There's no argument with that, but the difficulty is that I remain saying that these sanctions, I mean, will take too long to actually make an effect. I mean, Russia's losing population, yes. Russia, the oil and the energy is going to fall down, yes, with coming on stream of all the American and Canadian shale and tar oil. U.S. is going to be the largest producer, yes. But nevertheless, that will take place probably. It could take place long after the soldiers have moved. And then how do we get them out?
This new blacklist at the same time targets several influential businessmen who are actually known to be close to Putin. In a way, it seems that these sanctions actually get quite close to President Putin. Do you think that is something that could actually make the change?
Well, yeah, I mean, they've really got to, put as much pressure as possible on the inner sanctum of the Putin regime, the cronies, the mafiosos, the oligarchs. I mean, if you want to bring about a change, you've got to hit them hard. Unfortunately, you know, so far, as I say, some of these things really won't make much of a difference. But I agree with Kathleen, it is going to be a long process and we're not going to see an immediate change, but we have to get this process underway now, because Europe, for a start, has become too heavily dependent on Russian oil and gas. That needs to change in the longer term. We've been far too soft, I think, in the last few years with Putin's Russia. It's quite clear that it is an aggressive, authoritarian, undemocratic, illiberal regime, and therefore we need to change our posture for the longer term. As Kathleen mentioned, the shale gas revolution in America will certainly shake things up. So it's going to be a long-term process.
Do you think Russia is likely to retaliate? Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said that Russia may have to take a look at the stance it has taken in Iranian nuclear talks.
Well, the what's being mooted is that Russia says, well, instead of helping to try to sort out the nuclear thing, we'll say, all right, Iran, we'll build you a reactor and we'll barter oil for it. In other words, what Lavrov was threatening was to put a spanner in the works in the most appalling way. So yes, I mean, they could if they wanted to.
I mean, yes, I think that illustrates quite nicely, actually, the role that Russia occupies in the world today, because we must remember, Russia is not a superpower. It's no longer the Soviet Union. It lost the Cold War, and it's actually not terribly powerful in the sense of being in a superpower league. It can act as a spoiler. It can create an inconvenience.
And what can the US do in that situation if you think of Russia as a potential spoiler, when you think Russia threatening to ruin Iran's nuclear talks? That sounds quite irresponsible, doesn't it?
I think Putin does these things because he is aware that he isn't as strong as the United States. I mean, it's rather like jihadi suicide bombers. They're not being, they're incredibly brave. That's the only thing they can do to actually make an impact against a superpower. What can Russia do? Russia can make life so intolerable for the United States and Europe that they will make concessions because they're not going to march soldiers in.
So what is the approach the US should take when it comes to Russia and Russia behavior?
Well, I think that for a start, they're moving in the right direction by basically suspending the G8. As Merkel said today, the G8 really now in this environment no longer exists and there won't be the Sochi summit. So they need to isolate Russia diplomatically on the world stage. Putin craves attention. He craves legitimacy. He wants to be taken seriously. They need to box him in and cut them down as much as possible, really to remind them at the end of the day that you cannot behave like this. This is not the 19th century anymore, and makes right is no longer a principle that can be applied in international relations.
Unless it's in Crimea, of course.
Well, indeed, and that's why, you know, it's got to be shown that this is not acceptable.
Shall we move forward and continue with news from Syria? Almost half of Syria's declared stockpile of chemical weapons has now been removed. This according to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. How big news are we talking about over here?
Well, this is very significant because, of course, Syria has one of the largest stockpiles of chemical weapons, not only in the Middle East, but in the world. Though I would caution that they are way behind their deadlines. I believe that actually the priority one chemicals, the most toxic, dangerous chemicals, were supposed to be shipped out of the country by the end of December. And that's still not, has not been completed. And the same with the priority two chemicals as well. They were all supposed to be out by April, but actually now it's being pushed back to June. However, it is headed in the right direction. They've destroyed about 45% of all the chemical stockpiles. So I think they are making progress.
What do you think, Kathleen? How well has the Syrian government acted?
The Syrian government? Well, I mean, they're doing what's necessary and as little as possible, obviously. The one problem with Ukraine is they give it their nuclear weapons. That is an obvious red light to any other country who wants nuclear weapons. Don't give them up because look what happens to you. The Syrian regime, if they do have still some chemical weapons, that means they can bargain with Russia as well because Russia is rather close. So they will give them up if they're forced to give them up. They're giving them up, dribbling them out. They are in the right way, as Matthew says. But they need Russian transport. They need the Russian containers and so forth. This is an international group that are trying to get rid of this. And Syria, the problem is if Syria pulls in its, you know, puts its heels in the ground, and how many crises can the world deal with at one time if they're marching into Crimea and no one notices Syria? Syria's in a rather good position at this point, in fact.
And Damascus is said to be planning general elections in June. It seems, is it just pretending that they can conduct business as usual?
Oh, it's a complete farce. I mean, that regime is one of the most appalling regimes in the world today in terms of the most barbaric activities that they have conducted against innocent women and children. And the fact that a government has been slaughtering and butchering its own people. One of the most fundamental tenets of a government is to protect and uphold the safety of the population at all times. And they have violated that in the most perverse and grotesque way. So for me personally, this will, of course, it cannot be properly ended just because the chemical weapons are gone. Eventually, that whole Assad gang will have to go, and then the country will have to be run properly, democratically, for all the people of Syria.
Don't we wish so? I mean, I'm not convinced that Assad regime will go because there's too much standing on it. I mean, the Christians and Alawi tribes will only survive if Assad's in shape. If Assad Syria is one of the very few Shia Muslim states. Iran's another, of course. Part of Iraq is another. And it's hard to imagine that Iran would allow a Shia regime in Syria to fall. I mean, the question is, the key here is Saudi Arabia, of course, because they're funding, they're financing most of the jihadi Sunni fighters. So elections, what's interesting to me is that since, you know, in the past 50, 60, 70 years, the idea of an election is so totemic that even the most appalling countries say we're going to have them, and that's a good thing.
And what's the point of that in the end when they have elections and there are no surprises whatsoever?
Well, it's a sort of a smoke and mirrors exercise, you know, to try to, to give the impression and the imprimatur of democratic legitimacy. But it's a complete hoax and a farce.
Well, I think most people know that in that sense. I mean, as in Egypt, are we going to have a spurious legitimacy? If you can say you've had an election, Crimea, shall we say, somehow to a certain constituency, that, as you, the word is exactly right you used, Matthew, legitimacy. That's what it puts on it.
We're going to continue with a very short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sipi, Kathleen Burke and Matthew Jameson. When we return, we'll assess whether bankers' practices have changed at all since the financial crisis.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau.
Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, joins us now from Tokyo. Can you explain a little bit about this turnaround in price?
The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House.
They're claiming that these are going to be the most compact games of all time.
And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. Plus, don't forget the Daily Monologue, an op-ed piece from one of Monocle's globe-trotting editors. From the sublime to the occasionally ever so slightly ridiculous, find out what the minds inside Midori House are thinking. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 22:21 in Moscow, 18:21 in London, and 14:21, well, 2 now in Washington, D.C. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Matthew Jameson. Let's look at the latest news from Venezuela. Daniel Ceballos, the opposition mayor of the town where the anti-government protests started, has been arrested on charges of inciting violence. A month ago, Leopoldo López, leader of the Venezuelan opposition, was detained on similar charges. He is still behind bars. Those in the streets denounce these arrests as repressive and a violation of their rights. And meanwhile, President Nicolas Maduro denounces the U.S. as the puppet master behind the unrest. A few days ago, he asked Barack Obama to join a peace commission mediated by the Union of South American Nations. Kathleen, let me come to you first. Do you think, does Maduro have a point when he says that the US has a vested interest in ousting him from power?
Well, I mean, the United States always prefers a government that isn't so threatening to property interests and isn't quite so left-wing, as you might say. But I don't see how the U.S. would have much to gain by getting rid of Maduro. He's very well on the way to getting rid of himself. In fact, he's not going to need help from anyone else. And certainly the idea of that there are factions in the U.S. government that want to assassinate him. Well, that's sort of like holding elections in authoritarian societies we were speaking about earlier. It's just not credible.
Yeah, I mean, the situation in Venezuela is very interesting because, of course, there's not a lot of attention being paid to it at the moment with Ukraine and Syria, etc. But there's really quite a protest movement kicking off there. And it'll be interesting to see whether it actually comes to something greater, like in the Arab Spring.
President Maduro keeps reminding the world that he was democratically elected less than a year ago. But do you think, is his government actually acting democratically with these arrests?
From what I've read, it sounds no, definitely not. It sounds as if it's a politically motivated partisan campaign of intimidation to try to repress the opposition, to try to silence them and their leading spokesmen and figures, and a lot of these charges and so on seem trumped up.
And indeed, as I said earlier, a few days ago, President Maduro asked Barack Obama to join a peace commission mediated by the Union of South American Nations. Kathleen, do you think Obama should actually start a dialogue with Maduro of some sort?
Oh, well, jaw-jaw instead of war-war, I suppose. It wouldn't hurt, but it's hard to see what they would talk about. Stop attacking me. No, I won't. I'm not attacking you. Stop attacking me. There's a, you to negotiate, you have to have something to negotiate over. I mean, what Maduro says, U.S., leave us alone. And what the U.S. says, well, what would you like us to stop doing? So it's a PR thing there. It's to satisfy his own supporters and indeed those other countries in Latin America who agree with his politics.
Let's continue from the crackdown on protesters to the crackdown on bankers, or one rogue trader at least. Former Societe Generale trader Jérôme Kerviel is going to jail for running up to $50 billion worth of unauthorized deals. But France's highest court has ordered a review of the amount he's been condemned to pay. Originally, he'd been de facto blamed for all the misgivings of Source Gen, and he'd been ordered to reimburse the French bank the $4.9 billion it had lost over his actions. The court said that the previous judgment had not taken into account the bank's own responsibility. Kerviel, currently on a pilgrimage from Rome to Paris, has called this ruling a victory, even though his 3-year sentence has been upheld. Kathleen, does this all seem fair?
What's not fair is letting banks off the hook. He was not the head of his department. He was not, the line manager, as it were. If they didn't know what he was doing, as the bank is claiming, that is a quite astonishing abdication of responsibility, considering the billions of euros that were wandering around. As is the case, whilst he was making money, they didn't want to notice how he made it. I think it was unfair that he was a wrongdoer. Bankers have traditionally pushed the boundaries until they're stopped. But I don't think he was wholly responsible. I agree with that ruling fully.
In a way, this ruling is a reminder of how irresponsible our financial institutions can be. Matthew, do you think, should we do more?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just astonished that we haven't done even more. When you think about it, when was the financial crisis broken? It was only about 5 years ago, and it's still going on. It's been the most horrendous financial crisis and economic crisis in living memory. And so many people's lives have been ruined and destroyed through having their jobs lost, their pensions affected, their property, their savings. And yet, so few people have been actually held to account and prosecuted and put in jail for this. It's astonishing. And my mind goes back to, of course, I mean, during the riots in the summertime in 2011, of course, those who rioted must be punished and put in jail. And you know, the law was broken. Absolutely right. But actually, the damage, the economic damage that was inflicted during that period is a drop in the ocean compared to the economic damage we've all been living through over the last few years, thanks to a lot of very, very greedy, very irresponsible people.
So what exactly would you like to see happening first?
Well, first of all, I would actually really, this whole culture of bonuses really has got to be cut down. I mean, it's obscene. It's grotesque, the amount of money they are paid. Nobody needs that amount of money, and nobody is ever worth that amount of money, especially the work that they do is actually, as the former chairman of the Financial Services Authority said, not really very socially useful for the rest of us. So actually, I think we should legislate to perhaps, you know, just scrap bonuses altogether in the financial services sector.
Kathleen, do you agree?
Well, that will certainly make a lot of property available in the City of London, I must say. I mean, the problem is, if bankers are doing something illegal, then you can do it. If bankers are doing what bankers do and it's not illegal, I don't agree with you. I think it's a powerful thing to say these bankers have destroyed lives, but it's hard to say which banker you're going to put in jail, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So getting down to one can walk the walk.
Of course.
Easier just to talk the talk.
Yeah. I mean, I would sort of narrow it to the senior leadership, actually. You know, at the end of the day, the buck stops with the masters of the universe at the very top of the chain.
And finally, just before we go, one more small story. Our listeners know that I present our food and drinks show, The Menu, and I just couldn't resist bringing this up. Spain is now officially the world's biggest wine producer. Its vineyards have produced 50 million hectolitres. That is 6.7 billion bottles of wine in 2013. Kathleen, you are quite a wine expert. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, several thoughts. First of all, that a lot of that wine isn't bottled. It's distilled into brandy, cheap brandy. It's absolute oceans and rivers. A lot of the main grape in that area, of course, is a grape that one really wouldn't want to use, the Aran grape, which is a lot of Russian bad wine comes out of it as well. It's a nice thing to say we're making more wine than France. And there's certainly the case that Spanish wine has improved terrifically, but the one area of Spain where most of this surplus is coming from is not the area of Spain with the best wine.
Matthew, are you a fan of Spanish wine?
Well, actually, I'm more a fan of where Kathleen, we were originally talking about where she hails from in Northern California, the Napa Valley. and I was a great fan. I'm sure maybe Kathleen would know of the American wine soap saga Falcon Crest, which starred Ronald Reagan's first wife, Jane Wyman. In terms of Spanish wine, I haven't really given it a great exploration.
Matthew Jameson from Rosie and Catherine Burke from UCL in London. Thank you very much for this. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu sou o London. This is Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty more to come on the second half of today's Midori House. We'll hear about the results of the local elections in Amsterdam. We'll find out why real estate moguls, not filmmakers, took over the Cannes Croisette last week. And we'll bring you our weekly book review. But before we get started on all that, here is Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
The United States has announced it's imposing another wave of sanctions on Russia as the crisis in Ukraine continues. The latest sanctions target 20 individuals, including Vladimir Putin's chief of staff and a number of others who are close to the Russian president. EU leaders are currently meeting in Brussels and are expected to agree their own package of sanctions. The international search for debris that may be linked to the missing Malaysia Airlines plane has been halted for the day after bad weather hampered attempts by Australia, New Zealand and the US to find two objects spotted by satellite imagery around 1,500 miles southwest of Perth. A senior UN official has warned of terrifying levels of hatred between rival communities in the Central African Republic. Human rights chief Navi Pillay has just returned from a two-day visit there. She says she saw evidence of extreme violence, torture and even cannibalism. Almost half of Syria's stockpile of chemical weapons has now been removed from the country, according to officials overseeing the operation. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says it's hoping to destroy or remove all of Syria's chemical arsenal by the end of June. And police in South Africa will have to launch an investigation into corruption allegations against the country's president. They've been made by the main opposition party, a formal complaint over Jacob Zuma's use of public money to improve one of his private homes. It cost taxpayers $23 million. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It is time now to check in with one of Monocle's correspondents around the world, and today we head to Amsterdam to check in with Monocle's contributor there, Cynthia Taylor. Welcome to the programme, Cynthia. Shall we start with the latest on the local elections?
Well, local elections are not really the most relevant elections one can think of usually, but these have been quite historical elections here in the Netherlands. There have been quite a few firsts. First is that the Dutch Labour Party, which is currently in government, was the biggest loser. And it lost in most municipalities where it had seats, and most notably here in Amsterdam, where it was the main party since 1949. So it's been a big, big defeat for them. And they were defeated by the Liberal Democrats, D66, which sit in the opposition in parliament, in the national parliament. Now, you can say that these have been some sort of let's say, clear messages from the voters regarding where the national government is going, where national policies are going, and the voters just took their stand by voting differently in their local elections, you can say that.
And also, Cynthia, you actually have an audio clip for us. Would you like to explain what that is going to be all about?
Surely. Now, probably the most known Dutch politician is not the Prime Minister, but hardliner Geert Wilders from the Freedom Party. And it's an ironic name, since he actually stands for anti-Islam. And yesterday in The Hague, where he was set to win the most seats, but he actually didn't, he asked his supporters a question. He asked them, would you like more or fewer Moroccans in the Netherlands? And they said almost in unison, fewer, to which he said, well, we'll take care of that. And that's basically what this clip represents.
Willen jullie in deze stad en in Nederland meer of minder Marokkanen? Dan gaan we dat regelen.
Now, obviously, this kind of chanting has drawn some hard criticism across the board from political parties. Some are accusing Geert Wilders of inciting hate. Anti-discrimination bureaus here are overloaded with complaints. According to a local television here in Amsterdam, they actually received a record of complaints of people saying that Geert Wilders was discriminating against the Moroccans here. They said they received over 200 complaints by now. Also, the main daily newspaper, the NRC, and the commercial television RTL News, they have actually taken a stand against Wilders. They said, well, we are releasing our editorial opinion here, saying, well, we believe you went too far. You are instigating a climate of deportation, and you should be deeply ashamed. Now, the Moroccan community also took their stand, and they took it to Twitter, and basically they've been tweeting selfies with their Dutch passport and hashtag born here. I think it's a very strong statement from them. And also on Facebook, you can see a page with more than with about 40,000 people saying, I'm issuing a complaint against Geert Wilders. Now, Wilders himself, he's not apologizing. He says, I have said absolutely nothing wrong.
Cynthia, moving on to your second topic, US President Obama is going to be visiting Amsterdam next week. So how is the preparation work for that going? And what is the general mood in the city?
Well, this is a lot of excitement. Beyoncé was just here, and I don't think there was as much excitement as the visit of President Obama, I must say. Now, yes, Barack Obama will be here on Monday ahead of the nuclear summit that is taking place in The Hague. It's the first time that the US president officially visits Amsterdam. Now, the visit will cost some 360,000 euros to the city, mostly in security. Obama will meet with the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, and with Amsterdam's mayor, and they will be meeting at the Rijksmuseum. If you well remember, the museum reopened last year after a 10-year renovation. And in the meeting, of course, they will be discussing bilateral relations. And afterwards, they will enjoy a 15-minute tour by the museum's director. And the tour will finish where the Night Watch by Rembrandt is on display. Now, the whole excitement led hotels around the museum area to be fully booked. There's been a rush to get rooms after it was rumored that the president would visit the Rijksmuseum. Now, the likelihood of people seeing the US president is very, very small. I mean, there's tight security, and he will actually leave the area in a chopper. So you might get a glimpse of the helicopter. Not so sure if you'll get a glimpse of the president. But if you are a fan and you want to take your chances, well, Obama should take off around 11 in the morning on Monday from Museum Square.
That sounds great. And then one more thing before I let you go. What's going on over there in Amsterdam's trams? Supposedly, Amsterdam's tram system is scrapping English from their announcements.
It is true. English is being scrapped from the tram's announcement. Now, that was something very handy for those who didn't speak Dutch. because you'd be on the tram and all of a sudden people would hear an announcement in Dutch saying Spau. Now, what is Spau? And in the English announcement would tell you, well, it's a courtyard with a chapel. Or you would hear Albert Kalpstraat, and then the English announcement would say it's famous Amsterdam street market. And this has been going on since 2009, but the tram company has decided to stop it. They say that sometimes the distance between stops in the center is too short and there's no time for the full multilingual announcement, so they have to cut it short and people get annoyed by it. Of course, there are some organizations that are very happy about it, those who are very protective of the Dutch language. They've even issued complaints before at the municipality saying that there should be no English announcements. Dutch is the language of the country. But in fact, the party that just won most seats in the local council, they actually have been asking for English to become an official language of the city. So they might be fighting to get these English announcements back in the tram, even though the tram company says, well, this might just be a temporary stop. We were looking into solutions to see how we can benefit both the Dutch people and the English-speaking people.
That's very interesting. It's going to be exciting to see what's going to happen in the end. That was Cynthia Taylor with the latest news from Amsterdam. Up next, Josh Fennert will be here to discuss the importance of the MIPIM Real Estate Trade Show in Cannes. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
On this week's edition of The Culture Show with Robert Bound,
we'll check out New York's Armory Show of Art, we'll check into Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel, and speak to the advertising icon, John Hegarty.
That's The Culture Show with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Each spring, the movers and shakers of the property world decamp to the city of Cannes on France's Mediterranean coast for MIPIM, the industry's annual trade show. The 20,000-strong crowd and 4,000 exhibitors that descend on the city offer a unique snapshot of the property industry as a whole, as well as a window into how our cities will look in years to come. Well, I'm joined in the studio now by Monocle's very own Josh Fennert, who made the arduous journey to the French Riviera last week. Welcome to the program, Josh. Could you first tell us a bit about MIPIM's background? What does it essentially, what is the purpose it essentially serves?
Well, in essence, MIPIM is, it's in its 25th year for a start, so it's kind of a long-running mainstay of the property industry. But in essence, the purpose it serves is to bring together all manner of people. This is the this means the architects, the developers, the city planners, and even the mayors, who are basically pitching ideas to change the face of the cities, to put big infrastructure projects in place, and basically kind of plan for the future, and also discuss the future of urbanism and the way in which our kind of cities look. So it's kind of a melting pot for these people to talk and discuss the developments.
And what would you say, what are the advantages of MIPIM and what are the advantages it's offering for people who actually attend?
Well, the first example you actually alluded to earlier, I mean, it's on the French Riviera, it's in Cannes. There's something of a kind of a glamorous atmosphere about the place. There is obviously an annual film festival there, and there's a little bit of that kind of glitz that goes into the property fair as well. There's a lot more kind of suited money men shrewdly observing what architects are up to, but there is a kind of an element of glamour. I actually caught up with Peter Murray, who is the director of NLA, which is a New London Architecture, a think tank based in the city, to kind of hear his thoughts on MIPIM and what he'd seen so far.
The interesting thing about being down here is you can talk to people in a totally different way than you can back in London. You can open up about things, you can talk things off the record, you can make progress in negotiations in a way that you just don't back home. So from that point of view, it's important. I think that it's important in that it does show London in comparison to a lot of other cities. You can look and see what Paris is doing, you can see what Turin is doing and Moscow. Places like that, which are, I might say, competitors on the world stage, but also places that we can learn a lot from. So it's very useful to see what's happening. And I think that a lot of issues to do with development in London are about breaking down silos, about communication between the various groups involved. And here you have local authorities, you have private investors, you have planning committee members, you have councillors. All those people getting together to debate what's happening in London is really just a good thing, I think.
That was Peter Murray speaking. And Josh, when you are now back, I actually notice you're slightly tanned, slightly browner than normally. I'd like to hear what people actually talked about. What were the biggest headlines at this year's MIPIM, and what were people talking about over there?
Well, as you can imagine, there are a lot of competing voices in a kind of venue of 20,000 people. Each city put forward its own case for, you know, why it's kind of seeking investment. But the main headline was London. It had a huge pavilion dedicated to itself outside of the main exhibition centre, and a lot of the buzz that that kind of surrounded the place involved plans in London, the huge inflow of capital, and there are two schools of thought on the matter. Some people think that you know, it's excellent, there are investments, there's money for new projects, but other people feel a little bit as if money coming in from abroad causes a kind of a black spot where people, you know, people buy houses, they build houses, and no one actually lives in them. So it's not good for the kind of fabric of the city.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that discussion. What I'm wondering over here is that how do you actually assess a market, say, the market of London? And at the same time, I'm wondering what the conclusion was at this year's MIPIM. Is London an overheated market?
Well, the conclusion is that people planning for London's future should be planning very carefully. There is a lot of talk that the expansion of the market is, you know, it's going too fast, it's going too quickly, and we're not quite sure how to anticipate the flow of money into the city because it's an unprecedented circumstance. But most people are optimistic, and where there's optimism, you know, there are good ideas, and there are ideas that are more likely to get built. Interesting, I caught up with the director of the fair, Philippe Rian, who had some interesting things to say.
25 years is a long history, especially for an event. I would say there is MIPIM is now in a new phase after the crisis, so we definitely are not replicating the MIPIM of 07, 08. We have less people than there, even though this is the third MIPIM in terms of number of participants. So we are back to the pre-bubble levels, which is good. And we don't want a overheated MIPIM because a overheated MIPIM means that there is an overheated industry underlying it. You know, MIPIM is just a platform that reflects the status of the underlying industry and maybe even amplifies a little bit the waves of the industry. So I think it's quite healthy to see that the industry is reacting, I would say, in an orderly and pragmatic way to the crisis. No one really wants to go back to the heated years.
That was Philippe Rien, director of MIPIM. Josh, basing on what you saw at this year's MIPIM, what are the current trends and how has the market changed?
Well, as Philippe kind of mentioned there, there's a bit of soul searching. There's a kind of movement to sort of rehabilitate the image of property developers. He actually said, he said to me after the interview that no one ever accuses a furniture maker of doing it just for the money. And I think that people have in the past accused property developers of doing just that. So the trend seems to be towards rehabilitating that image and kind of building housing stock that's there to last, but that's obviously also an investment too.
And now that you are back from MIPIM, I have to ask one more question. What made you particularly excited at this year's MIPIM?
I think the venue is all. It's in the same exhibition centre as the film fair. Everyone is very, very glamorously dressed. The property world doesn't move that quickly, but people move very quickly in and out of the bars. So it's also quite a fun place to be, as well as a serious one.
That was Monocle's Josh Fennert discussing the International Real Estate Fair MIPIM. Thank you very much. It is 7:49 a.m. in Auckland, 22:49 in Moscow, 18:49 in London, and 11:49 in San Francisco. We continue with a bit of music. We just heard From the Wonders of France, well, the south of France at least. So let's stay there for a little longer with the sounds of the Franco-British band The Night Six. This is Sienna.
I hope you're happier with Sienna. I hope she makes it good the way I never could. I hope you marry her, that Sienna girl in an orange grove, the way we always said we would.
That was The Night Six with Sienna. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and like every Thursday, we now tell you which books you should add to your reading list. I'm joined by writer and journalist Mark Mason for a review of what is hitting the presses. Welcome to the programme, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Your first book is called Odd Job Man. It's a fascinating memoir of a slang expert.
Yeah, a guy called Jonathan Green, who's been compiling dictionaries of slang for 40-odd years now. And he's collected 125,000 slang terms from around the world. Obviously, a lot of them are British and American because he does his dictionaries in English. But he's fascinated talking about his life and why he got into it. And he picks out two things. He was an only child and he was Jewish. Mm-hmm. And he said both of those things have made him feel an outsider. And he loves the thought. He's got this fantastic phrase of compiling dictionaries is a passport to non-participation, getting as far away as possible from the messiness of the world, but at the same time arrogantly setting oneself up as one of its arbiters. So he's sort of what he's listening. It's like someone sitting in a cafe. That was the impression I had reading the book, of someone sitting in a cafe listening to everyone else's conversations, you know?
And what do you learn about slang in the end when you read that book? I just saw this number somewhere that he has built a lexis of 125,000 words, and that includes about 1,700 words for sexual intercourse and 219 for vomiting.
Yes, and the sexual intercourse gets even more detailed, and we probably shouldn't go into the particular details of how he splits it up. But he says that slang always comes back to the same three human desires: sex, money, and intoxication. Sex, money, getting drunk, basically. And because they're the things that humans have always done, and presumably will always do. And every generation, he calls it linguistic patricide. We all feel the need to rebel against our parents, to invent new terms for these words. And, you know, our parents had various slang. And, you know, some of them stay around, like the F word is always around, and its derivations are always around. But we feel the need to constantly reinvent them. And he says it's rather like tribes who used to kill their leaders and water next year's crops with the blood of their leaders. And that's what we do with slang. Whenever we come up with each generation has its own slang, we're sort of killing our parents. You
know? That sounds absolutely fascinating. We have to move on to your second book now before we run out of time. It's called Ilk Stopped Play. What can you tell us about it?
It's about Wisden, the cricket Bible. Anyone who's in a cricket-playing country around the world will know that Wisden is the Bible of the game. It does a huge, big slab of a book that comes out. It's about 3 feet thick every year. And they have a section called Cricket Round the World, of all the places where the minor countries that cricket's played in. And the title comes from the fact that in Finland, an elk did stop play. This cricket match had to be interrupted because an elk ran onto the pitch.
Did you know I'm from there?
I didn't. There we go.
Yeah.
What a small world.
What a small world. But do we actually play cricket that much?
You do. And apart from when an elk runs onto the pitch, which is... And the elk, I couldn't believe how big elks are. This one apparently was twice the size of a horse.
Finnish elks.
Are they huge?
They are massive.
This is fantastic. The things you learn in a radio studio. I didn't realise we were going to be talking about elks in quite this detail. Yeah, absolutely huge. Lots of other things around the world stop play, like unexploded landmines in Rwanda and mortars in Iraq. They played in Saddam's, at one of Saddam's old palaces, the English and Australian troops, and they played in the huge room in one of his palaces. And if you hit the ball onto one landing of the staircase, it was a 4. Onto the next landing, it was a 6. Incredible games.
That sounds amazing. It sounds like that's a book. You don't need to be a cricket lover, actually, to like that book.
I think it's just mental. The way that different countries around the world play the same game. There's one Sri Lankan bowler who kisses the ball every time before he delivers it, before he runs in to bowl it, which is just bizarre.
Very interesting books, and we still have time to talk about one book. It's called Brief History of Whistling.
Yeah, this is it's a book by some academics who study working class culture and the study of workers around the world, and how their big thing is that whistling is a way of getting through the work. If you're on a low-paid job and sort of manual labour, whistling's important to you. And lots of employers, apparently, throughout history have banned their employees from whistling. Like in the States, Henry Ford of the Ford Motor Company banned his employees from whistling. So they do that and various little bits of culture, like whistling in science fiction. There was an android in Star Trek once, apparently. The one human thing it couldn't do was whistle. It managed to be a perfect human in every other respect, this android, but it couldn't whistle.
Exactly. And what's your conclusion? Are we going to be whistling in the future as well?
I think we always will, by the sounds of it. My favourite story that isn't in the book, actually, about whistling is Paul McCartney says he knew the Beatles had made it when he woke up one morning and the guy delivering his milk was whistling one of the Beatles songs. And he thought, that's it. My milkman's whistling my songs. That's it. The Beatles have made it.
That was journalist and writer Mark Mason with 3 book recommendations for this week. Thank you very much for this, Mark. And that's already all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Kathleen Burke and Matthew Jameson, and of course to Mark Mason as well. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlota Repello. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next is The Urbanist with David Michaud, and this week it is all about hipsters. How can the of-the-moment tastemakers leave a long-term impact on a city? That is the question the programme will answer. And then at 2200 hours London time, it's the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Ted Kravitz. And this show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, thank you for listening and goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.